The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. This week on Century, we're going to hear from Michelle Newhart and William Dolphin. They're the authors of a new book, The Medicalization of Marijuana, Legitimacy, Stigma, and the Patient Experience. It's just out from Routledge Press. So could you tell our listeners a little bit about yourselves first?
Sure. So I am William Dolphin, and I've been working on medical cannabis-related issues since about 2001, 2002, first with Ed Rosenthal's federal trial in San Francisco, and then since then with a variety of patient advocacy organizations, including Americans for Safe Access. Folks who get the monthly newsletter from ASA may know me because I'm the one who sends that out. But I'm also a teacher of writing at the University of Redlands and have been at other places too. And Michelle and I have known each other for quite a long time around this, back to the Ed Rosenthal days.
Yeah. And now we're married.
Now we're married. That's right. And part thanks to all this, I guess. Yes.
And I'm Michelle Newhart. I have my PhD in sociology from the University of Colorado at Boulder. And prior to graduate school, I worked as an editor for Ed Rosenthal's publishing company for about 8 years. So I've been doing research and writing about cannabis and medical cannabis since about 1999.
Now, Michelle, you write in the book, in the foreword, in the preface, I guess, whatever it's called. You write in the book that marijuana chose you. Now, I think I know what you mean, but could you explain that for the listeners?
I guess what I meant by that is cannabis seemed to find me. I didn't go looking for cannabis. I became a sociologist, and I ended up working in cannabis initially with Ed because I literally cold answered an ad in the newspaper. And then when I left from working for Ed, I went to graduate school in Colorado thinking my days of working on cannabis were done. And lo and behold, everything blew up in Colorado while I was in graduate school. And so I found myself working on that issue again.
Let's talk first about stigma, if that's all right. As I mean, I talk about stigma on this show quite a lot. We talk about stigma a lot in drug policy reform and harm reduction in general. But tell me about stigma in the context of the general social use of marijuana.
Well, stigma attaches to cannabis use, period, right? And we see that in all aspects of it. And it doesn't matter where you are. At the point where you identify as a cannabis user, you're open to being stigmatized. And you know, the claim we make in the book is that the most consequential social construction of the 20th century is cannabis. Medical marijuana has driven a wedge into that because it differentiates the use, right? I mean, there's a sort of single story about what it means to be a marijuana user and what marijuana is. And that's a drug of abuse that's only purpose is intoxication in some problematic way. And, of course, medical cannabis use is entirely different, and that is the transition that it's going through. But even with all of the many states that have enacted programs and the growing body of research about it and the growing public acceptance of it, you know, as you know, Doug, you know, the public opinion polls, 86% of Americans think you should have legal access if your doctor recommends it to you. But nonetheless, people are super sensitive to being stereotyped around it, and that affects everything. That affects how they interact with their families, with their colleagues at work, and with their doctors.
Well, and as we know, that stigma is in large part by design. It was structured into how the laws work, and stigma and legitimacy can be seen as two ends of a pole of how we understand this issue. And it's also a behavioral stigma. So like other behaviors, it's something that is in a moment and can be hidden or disclosed. And that makes it a special type of stigma. And so public identification becomes a very important part of understanding how that stigma works.
More specifically toward medical, now I live in Portland, Oregon. That's the home of the National College of Naturopathic Medicine. You don't have to live, in fact, we have more naturopaths in the state of Oregon and in this area than pretty much any other state in the country. You don't have to live here, though, to know that alternative therapies, complementary and alternative therapies have been growing in popularity for the past few decades. And in spite of the growing acceptance and use of complementary and alternative therapies, I prefer cat to cam, partly because I like cats, but also because when people think medicines, they think drugs. And when people think acupuncture and the like, therapies might be a more inclusive word. So that's why, but in your book, you'd refer to them as cam. But anyway, in spite of that growing acceptance and use of these complementary and alternative therapies, there are still a lot of medical doctors who are, to say the least, skeptical, so much so that a lot of people just lie to their doctors about their use of these therapies. So talk to me for a moment about the stigma around that, around the use of generally of complementary and alternative therapies or medicines.
Well, when I decided to write about this, I was already writing about complementary and alternative therapies and thinking about how those were affected by the changes in the law that allowed nutritional supplements to market directly to consumers. And those laws changed in 1996, the same year that we got our first medical cannabis laws in California. And I started asking people when we did interviews about how they saw cannabis fitting with other complementary and alternative medicines. And I expected people to see them as similar, but it was interesting that most medical cannabis patients didn't see them in the same category. Yet, from the physician side, I think you're right. I think we've seen developments in integrative care over the last couple of decades since that time, and we've certainly seen some changes in the language that's used around complementary and alternative therapies. But even the latest study that just came out, there was Elon Conrad and colleagues in 2018 was interviewed primary care physicians and their patients about their various medical therapies that they used, including cannabis, and differentiating whether it was medical cannabis use or not. And it was clear that about half of them who reported using medical cannabis did not tell their primary care physician that they were doing so. So even that's a very contemporary study, and still showing that there's communication problems between doctors and patients around things outside of biomedicine.
Well, and as you can imagine, this concern for what we might call stereotype threats, just how people are going to categorize you based on disclosure, applies to all kinds of folks, and no less doctors. Doctors are authority figures. People are very concerned. Sociology has described this in the context of other kinds of doctor-patient interactions as well, that people are trying to manage those relationships, and disclosing sensitive information that may lead to being treated like you're, less of a person or the wrong kind of person may be hidden for sure. And, the consequence of that, on the one hand, may not seem like much, but one of the things that came out of that Congress study, there was a dual surveying, both the doctors and the patients separately, was that the doctors identified that 19% of their patients had conditions that they felt cannabis use might be contraindicated for. So not disclosing to the doctor what you're using it for can end up masking some more important problem that might be addressed through an alternative therapy than just cannabis use. So enabling solid communication between doctors and patients is important, and doctor education is the most important part of that. So we're seeing more development of CME and continuing medical education credits for doctors that are focused on endocannabinoid science and cannabinoid science. But there's still, to my knowledge, no medical schools in the United States that teach it.
Interesting. I'm intrigued when you talk, when you say that the patients didn't necessarily view the, did I get that right? You said that the patients don't necessarily view medical cannabis, medical marijuana. I prefer marijuana. I call it weed myself, but never mind. The patients don't necessarily view that as a part of a complementary and alternative, or did I misunderstand?
Well, no, they do. They do see it that way. I mean, they see it as part of their medical regimen. All the folks interviewed for this book are participating in, were participating in the state program, and certainly viewed their use through the lens of medicine. Did they explicitly think of it as complementary and alternative to medicine? No. And the classification of that comes more, I think, from the institutional medicine side. For instance, the National Cancer Institute lists cannabis as a CAM, as a complementary and alternative medicine. So that's more to the issue of the transition that it's undergoing as it's gaining more institutional acceptance, and the institutions of medicine are trying to figure out how to classify it and where to put it.
Hmm.
And I expected patients to who were interviewed to make that connection very readily. Many of them had disorders for which they'd been treated over a long period of time. They tried many pharmaceuticals, many of them had, and had tried various forms of complementary therapy. But when I asked them directly if they saw that connected to medical cannabis, they were ambivalent about that categorization.
You mentioned the patient interviews. You have quite a few in the book. You talk and there's a theme around midlife patients. Tell me about cannabis use among these midlife patients. What kind of characteristics did you find in common?
Well, sure. Midlife was of interest because that is the largest growing population who signs up for medical cannabis patient program. And the pattern of the majority were what you might expect. It was many had tried it in adolescence, and then as they took on more adult responsibilities, had kids, got more serious jobs and so forth, and moved into midlife, it had been a number of years since they had used cannabis. It kind of fell along the wayside somewhere in there. And then they tried it again through the medical lens in midlife. And so that was a common trajectory that we saw. But there were also a minority who had never tried it. And there were a minority who had tried it in adolescence, liked it a lot, and continued to use it throughout adult life, on and off or fairly consistently across adult life. So we saw all three of those patterns. But by far, the most common one was trying it in adolescence, maybe using it for some time during adolescence, and then desisting use over adult life, and then deciding to try it again medically in midlife.
And one of the interesting things that we found in it as well was that, while they may have had a basis of experience as young people, the idea of using it medically tended to come from family and friends. There was some type of intervention that was pretty commonly described where basically, these were folks, who had exhausted all the conventional medical remedies. This was medicine of last resort. And somebody came to them and said, hey, look, I'm pretty sure, based on what I've heard, that this is going to work for you. Sometimes very assertively, and convinced them to try it. Once they did embark on using it medically, one of the things that's super interesting is, the degree to which it matches the way folks use other medications. So there's an existing body of literature that has examined, you know, through research methods, how folks use medicines. And it matches up pretty darn well. And the term for it that we use is min-max strategy. So trying to minimize both the amount of medicine being used and the side effects of the medicine and maximize the ability to function in their lives. And again, this is common with pharmaceuticals. Everybody knows that, you know, sometimes people follow exactly what the doctor directs with the medication, but a lot of times there's some experimentation in terms of dosage and frequency, because everybody's trying to get that sweet spot of being able to be as functional as possible. And that was true under cannabis as well.
It was also interesting because we opened the book with two stories that we juxtaposed, one of Karen and one of Dale. And Karen was an example of that pattern we expect to see where she was, you know, had used it in adolescence and then had children and got married, had her job, you know, like a PTA mom and active in her church and all this kind of stuff. And then she actually came to it through her husband, who was in a car accident that led to a chronic pain condition. And she herself had migraines. And after his success with medical cannabis, she ended up trying it and finding it successful for her migraines. And the other story about Dale is he had been a, you know, kind of a juvenile delinquent who'd grown up using all kinds of recreational substances, including alcohol and cigarettes and many different types of drugs across his adult life. But not very much cannabis because that would get him hot on the drug test and he needed to be able to pass drug tests for the type of work that he did. So the interesting thing is that neither one came to it thinking that cannabis was going to be legitimately medical. And so it was interesting to me that despite whatever recreational background the patients had, often they weren't really convinced of its medical efficacy until they experienced it themselves or saw somebody very close to them experience it in that way.
Yeah, really what it reflects is that regardless of experience, that single story, the stereotype about cannabis use and cannabis itself, was really powerful. And so even if there was a lot of direct experience, there was still deep skepticism about medical utility.
This is an interview with William Dolphin and Michelle Newhart. They're the authors of The Medicalization of Marijuana, Legitimacy, Stigma, and the Patient Experience. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, the number of people who used for chronic pain was used by large numbers of people using medical cannabis for chronic and severe pain. And yet those numbers were being used by opponents to try and claim that medical marijuana was illegitimate because, pain, anybody can say. Now we have, in the context of an opioid overdose crisis, we have people, I think, starting to see pain relief and medical cannabis for pain relief as more than just legitimate. It's being seen as one way to relieve the overdose crisis. How has the perception of pain and the condition of pain, how do you think that's played into all this?
Well, I think you're exactly right, that there's growing awareness of the problems around treatment. Pain is the number one reason people go to doctors for treatment, and it's the thing they're most likely to say they're dissatisfied with the treatment they receive. And, you know, the U.S. Pain Foundation estimates you've got 100 million Americans with some kind of, you know, chronic pain syndrome. So, yeah, it's a significant problem, and opioids are, in many respects, you know, a useful tool, but they come with severe side effects, and as long-term treatments, they're extremely problematic, as we've seen. You know, in the U.S. with the epidemic problem. Now, one of the things that's happened recently is that we have increasing body of research about the combination therapies, that a little bit of cannabis goes a long way toward maximizing the effectiveness of opioids. So, and many people report being able to substitute one for the other as well. But we're understanding better the biology of how the synergism between those two drugs, classes of drugs really work. But, you know, more importantly, you know, folks are recognizing that there's a different safety profile. You know, there is no medicine with a better safety profile than cannabis. And so, I mean, I think the real challenge here is, again, moving it from a medicine of last resort to more of a frontline, first-line sort of alternative. And, you know, we'll see about that. Again, that's something that doctors are generally skeptical about, but, you know, patient experience is different.
Well, and you bring up something that is very sociologically relevant. So there were 40 patients interviewed in the study, and 90% qualified under a pain condition. But, you know, there the other conditions in Colorado can be more objective conditions, things like HIV or having a cancer diagnosis. And patients such as Brett in our study said, you know, I would qualify under the name of my condition if that were a condition that you could qualify under. But since it isn't listed as one of the qualifying conditions, many people qualify under pain, and the conditions are not exclusive, so you can qualify under more than one condition. So it doesn't necessarily add up to 100%. It wasn't everything else 10%, but most had as their primary condition pain.
Which can, of course, be a symptom of, you know, the other condition that you've got, that it's a good catch-all for a lot of folks in terms of qualifying. And, of course, you know, medical cannabis laws, medical marijuana laws are different than other types of medical practice because we generally trust doctors to make the determination about appropriate treatments. And when folks, you know, use drugs off-label, we don't usually get too concerned about it. But, you know, with marijuana, we've got a situation where we list, it's like these are the only things that you can prescribe or recommend this for. And that's a little bit different.
One of the other aspects of that, too, and it plays, it has to do with framing. So I think part of what you're bringing up is, you know, there's a period of time in which the media and the public presentation of this issue really was skeptical as well, and wondering if medical programs were simply a ruse for recreational users to find a legal way to use cannabis. And I think we've seen some of that shift in terms of how it's being framed with the opioid crisis, and it provides a different way of understanding that and may take some of that pressure away from that way of framing it. But I think pain is a subjective condition, and whether you're treating it with cannabis or opioids, this is a problem area for doctor-patient relationships generally because it is subjective. And so this is, reported also. If you look at other types of treatment for pain, it's a concern. And part of the reason why, as William said, that cannabis provides a possible relief for the opioid crisis is its amazing safety profile. So there's more room for user error since you're not going to use it.
And from the physician point of view, the best clinical evidence is around pain. We have more clinical trials showing efficacy of cannabis for managing pain than for any other condition. So if you're an evidence-based physician, as they mostly are and should be, that's what you're going to have the most confidence in recommending for.
Again, folks, I'm speaking with Michelle Newhart and William Dolphin. Their new book is The Medicalization of Marijuana, Legitimacy, Stigma, and the Patient Experience. What do you hope, when they read your book, what are you hoping will be the big takeaways?
Well, it depends on who you are.
That's fair.
We have tried to do several things at once with this, you know, and that may be more or less successful depending on who you are. But, you know, first and foremost, this is an academic study. And there's a concern for legitimacy around the science side of this. Behavioral science is neglected looking at medical cannabis use. There are certainly some studies that are out there, but there's been very little. Almost all of it has looked at it, again, as a deviant behavior, not as positive or a therapeutic use. So, you know, kind of broadening the conversation on the academic side to say this is legitimate and it's a legitimate subject of study. And in fact, you know, we're 20 years into this social experiment of medical marijuana access. We really should take a look at what patients are actually doing, what they actually need as we're making decisions about it. So, you know, so an academic researcher can look at it and say, well, here's a really cool qualitative study that's going to give me some insight into a particular population that's understudied. If you're a policymaker, you should be able to look at it and say, I can make a much better set of decisions understanding what it is that people are actually doing and who these folks are. And if you're a patient yourself or you have a family member you think might be helped by medical marijuana, in some sense, I hope that it provides a little bit of, not a roadmap, at least something that's a way of having a touchstone to, this is kind of what these things are about. We organize the drug queue in the order in which people encounter the issues, the decisions that they have to make. So, you know, there's a sense of, I'm not in this alone. And again, because this is a concealable behavior and because of the stigma and stereotype, a lot of people hide it or they hide their concerns. They don't know who to ask about it. And our hope is that this is a book that will help folks break down some of those barriers.
You know, at best, I hope that it offers them new ways to think about it and to frame the issue. So the overarching theme of the book is medicalization, and medicalization is a process that's been studied in sociology since the 70s. And our overall argument says, you know, marijuana is undergoing medicalization, but that process is as of yet incomplete. And since it is in progress, and it's not necessarily a linear progress, there's no guarantee that it will be completed. But we can look at various things that are happening socially and policy-wise and think about how does that fit with this framing of understanding what's happening. And I think that's just one. I think we offer several other things of that type throughout the book, depending on which part you look at. And we talk about risks to patients, and we talk about stigma management, and offer some thoughts about how patients form a thought community and use similar strategies to manage stigma. And so these just give a different place to hang your hat and think about the issue overall and how different things fit within that.
That was my interview with Michelle Newhart and William Dolphin. They're the authors of a new book from Routledge Press, The Medicalization of Marijuana, Legitimacy, Stigma, and the Patient Experience. And well, that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. On the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage, drugtruth.net. Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course, also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.